Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Cathal Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Morning, Francis.
How are you this morning?
I'm very well. How are you?
I'm well, and I'm positive, and I'm, we talk about a lot of positive things on this show, but very often in the arena of how unhealthful food can be and
public policy.
We talk about things that are things we want to fight, things we want to change. Mm-hmm. But I've noticed that there are changes happening. And the more of the news that I read in the last, half a year or so has been good news. And do you know why, Mark?
Because people are listening to our show.
Because of our listeners. And the listeners and the advocates and all the other shows who are talking about bringing some sense to our food policy. Now, our farm policy is still a mess. And there's some issues that go a little too far.
Well, our food policy is still a mess, too. Just there are people who are making some changes.
And one of the areas I think of great victory across many states, which is surprising, is in our school lunch program. Now, this happened in England with Jamie Oliver, who's a celebrity chef in England. Became the cause celeb for him was to change. He realized that the school lunches they were serving in British schools were disgusting, and of course our kids have bad eating habits because instead they were eating out of the vending machine.
Mm-hmm.
We took up that the mantra here. A lot of people got behind it. Alice Waters out in California. We certainly got behind it, but a lot of advocates pushed for healthier school lunches for our kids. Now, initially, the big soft drink firms who make a lot of money selling soda in vending machines in schools.
They pushed very hard against anything like this.
And some of the big food companies really fought this. And what's happened is those food companies are coming around. And, of course, they're saying, they're coming around out of the benevolence of their own heart and has nothing to do with the fact that people are coming after them.
Well, I think one of the things that the food companies have taken note of is how important an issue this is to a lot of families in America and how much their choice is to get on board or they're going to get completely kicked off the train.
Food companies and large corporations respond when enough of their clients, their consumers, mm-hmm. you out there, say, you know what, mm-mm, this ain't flying. Anyway, the climate on the diet in public schools has changed, and a lot of the corporations have gotten on board.
I don't want to say it's changed. It's changing.
I'm sorry. The solution we don't have, but we're working toward it. And a lot of school districts are being very proactive in trying to get their kids to eat healthier in the face of the obesity epidemic with kids. And listen, just to briefly touch on the two sides to this, there are people who object to this. There are mm-hmm. people who say, it's freedom of choice. Well, the way I look at it, you're under 18. Your parents can't make the choice because you're away from your parents for 7 hours. No, you don't have freedom of choice. Kid doesn't have freedom of choice, and the parent's not there to exercise that choice. And so the school has to act in loco parentis and make sure that, we offer healthy foods to our kids and we don't offer too much opportunity for bad foods. And we're inculcating lifetime patterns that go with our kids and we see the results.
See, but I'm also of the belief that if your kid wants to bring in two bags of Ho-Hos and you want your kid to bring in two bags of Ho-Hos to lunch, that you should be allowed to bring your kid should be allowed to bring two bags of Ho-Hos in.
Yeah, but here's something that's come up recently in New Jersey and a couple of other states. There are certain schools that prohibit the bringing in of snacks to share with other students in the classroom.
For birthday parties and things like that, the cupcakes.
Bring in cupcakes,
sure.
You bring in one for the whole class.
Sure, of course.
And there are school districts that prohibit that, and that meets a lot of resistance. But if you think about it, if you have 30 kids in a class, that means every week you got cupcakes. I don't know. I don't know how I feel. I do think the school has a right to say yes or no, but what your kid brings in for his lunch, that's
what you decide for your kid to have.
But I think a school that allows cupcakes, I don't think that's crazy. But I think, there's a lot of other stuff that goes on, and and we have to offer healthy food, mm-hmm. and we also have to make the healthy food we offer in our kids' schools tasty.
It's got to be appealing. It's got to be appealing.
Do you remember
we have
the hamburgers
to offer
from school lunch?
Oh, of course I remember.
It's not. Or do you remember the vegetables from school lunch? It wasn't that I didn't like vegetables.
It was they came out of a giant number 10 can of vegetable stuff, and it was warmed and served from a trough. And who
right.
wants that?
Right. Exactly.
Who wants that? Certainly no kid wants that, and I don't know very many adults that want that.
I don't want that. So you know what? I might forego the healthy meatloaf thing that I was served in the ninth grade. And rather have a Twix bar to get me through the day.
Right.
You know?
The three-bean salad. Do you remember the three-bean, the canned three-bean salad?
No, I don't.
I do.
I know.
Came in the box lunch.
Never would have picked that up.
In the cold box lunch, I remember.
Well, there have been a number of articles recently. I'll take, for example, in California, deep fryers have been banned, so chicken nuggets and fries are now baked. Doesn't seem like a tremendous trade-off. Mm-hmm. In New Jersey, 20-ounce sports drinks have now been cut back to 12 ounces. We're going in baby steps here in Jersey. but, you know, here's the thing. This is from the New York Times. I'm going to read you a quote. Food and beverage companies have scrambled to offer healthier alternatives to school cafeterias and vending machines, and some of the changes have been met with a shrug by students. The whole wheat chocolate chip cookies, surprisingly, the kids have kind of embraced them, says Laura Jacobo, director of food services at Wood Lake Union Schools in California. No, it's not surprising. They're kids.
And, by the way, they are still chocolate chip cookies after all, okay?
But you know what? Honestly, if you take away the options, and especially when you talk about grammar schools, okay, you can fool your kids.
Mm-hmm.
Give them a carrot, tell them it's cookie. If it looks like a cookie. No, you can't fool them.
By the way, I got kids.
No,
you're
no,
not fooling them like that.
But the thing is, if you raise the kids with a certain expectation, mm-hmm. they will accept it.
Absolutely.
They will eat what you give them.
And they will also get used to eating healthier foods, and they'll enjoy them more after they've had them enough times. The one thing that you touched on a second ago that I want to go back to, though, is the sports drinks. Why do our vending machines in schools have to have sports drinks? Okay.
I don't know.
If you are a student athlete, okay, well, your coaches make sports drinks available when necessary. And frankly, when I was a student athlete, we had sports drinks for games and we had water when it wasn't game time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we got plenty of salt and nutrients and potassium, all those kinds of things.
What did the ancient Olympians do? Sports have been played for a long time.
I will tell you one thing. Remember the guy that they named the marathon for?
Yeah.
Well, he died at the end of the marathon, remember?
Yeah, but we don't have our kids run 26 miles. I think what this comes down to is, does the government have a right to get involved in the school, which is run by the government?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, we're not talking about adults who have a choice, freedom of choice. I don't think you should have freedom of choice. Our job, while you're there, our job is to teach you how to live. It's not to ask you how you want to live.
Yeah, it's a slippery slope, though. I don't want the school dictating too much. I mean,
But we're talking about what the school provides. Mm-hmm. We're not saying you can't bring in, you know, you want to give your kid five ho-hos for lunch. I'll call Dyfus on you, but yeah, go ahead.
You know? Again, though, but maybe I believe that ho-hos are the way to the promised land.
That would explain a lot. Now, wouldn't it? We'll be back in just a moment talking about some really good food with one of the world's experts on oysters. Rowan Jacobson has a new book out, and we'll be talking to him in just a moment. WCTC 1450, it's 11:15.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. Our guest today is Rowan Jacobson, returning. He has a new book called The Geography of Oysters, A Connoisseur's Guide to Eating the Oyster in North America.
Rowan, welcome to the show.
Hi, guys. Glad to be back.
Hey, man, last time you were on, we were talking about umami, the magic new taste that everyone has found.
Yeah.
And now you have this amazing book on oysters. You know, I'm an oysterophile.
I'm glad to hear it.
You know that I can leave my restaurant at 11 p.m. and be at my nearest, the best oysters in the shortest distance for me are the Blue Ribbon Oyster Bar on Sullivan Street in Manhattan.
Mm-hmm.
And from the moment I walk out my door, I can be at the bar with the oysters ordered and a beer in my hand in 37 minutes.
That sounds like a good way to chime in midnight. And what do you go for? Any particular oysters?
No, well, they always have Long Island oysters there. Mm-hmm. And then they usually have a couple of specials, so it's really from all around the world. But I hear that they are, per square footage, the largest oyster restaurant sales in the state of New York.
Wow.
Pretty cool, huh?
Yeah.
So tell us, now you asked me a question there, what kind of oysters do you like? Rowan, what kind of oysters are there?
Well, it's amazing. There are actually several hundred different varieties of oysters available in North America now. It's really changed in the past 20 years or so, as more and more oyster farmers have decided to start growing oysters on their specific bays so that they're producing oysters that have a unique flavor.
So are the different oysters different species of oysters, or are they just different types?
Some are different species. There's five different species of oysters that are produced in America.
Uh-huh.
On the East Coast, it's all pretty much just one oyster, the eastern oyster, from PEI all the way down to the Gulf.
Yeah, I think a lot of people don't realize that that's one breed of oyster, though the oysters can be so different depending on from where they come.
For those of you not listening from the East Coast, PEI is Prince Edward Island.
Right. You think of Malpec oyster, a Wellfleet, a Blue Point. You think they're all different species, but they're actually the exact same oyster, just being grown in different places.
But they taste very, very different. Why is that?
And that taste has everything to do with the waters that the oyster comes from. That's why I kind of feel that oysters are maybe the food that best expresses terroir, because they have a fairly mild flavor. So they're entirely dependent on focusing whatever influences are going on in their home waters in terms of salt content, minerals, different types of algae that contribute to their flavor.
I think there might be some grape growers in Burgundy that might disagree with you, but I think oysters certainly are up there for sure.
Yeah, well, go ahead.
Well, by saying that, I'm certainly there are a lot of wine guys who are going to get up in arms, but there's a lot of manipulation in the cellar that goes into making good wine, and with oyster, you know, it's the pure animal just delivered straight to you with no intervention.
Well, what Mark and Rowan are talking about is that there's an analogy here. People say with great wine that though it, you know, Pinot Noir in Burgundy is very very different than Pinot Noir grown in California, and Pinot Noir in the north of Burgundy is very different than the south of Burgundy, and even from one vineyard to another. And that's called, when wine geeks talk about it, that's called a terroir, or this the influence of a specific piece of land. And Rowan, I think what you're saying is that an oyster is all about terroir. It's not, you know, you can see the influence of terroir in the winemaking. It's like
it's 100%.
The only
right.
difference yeah. between oysters is where they come from.
Right. It ain't nothing but terroir.
And I love it when you get down and dirty. That's so it's with the common man. Well, and so there's the name of your book, A Geography of Oysters. Now, you talked about farming oysters. Are all the oysters we're eating these days farmed? I mean, and didn't it used to be that people would just go out and collect oysters in the wild?
Yeah, it did. When the settlers first came to the New World, their jaws dropped open at the incredible billions of numbers of oysters that lined every harbor, particularly New York Harbor. But they made short order of those oysters. They were wiped out. The last Wellfleet oyster disappeared about 1775. The last New York wild oysters were gone by the mid-1800s. Chesapeake wild oysters held on through the middle of the 20th century and then tanked, and there's not many of them left either.
Now, are they gone, or just below commercial levels that you can harvest them?
In New York and Boston, Massachusetts, they're gone. We still get wild oysters in the Chesapeake, a few. The Gulf of Mexico is still holding out pretty strong. They still produce maybe 20 million pounds a year of wild oysters.
Are they in New York and Boston, are they gone because we simply of over-harvesting?
Is that a water problem or is a fishing problem?
It's mostly a fishing problem. The over-harvesting was really what did them in. Pollution in the late 19th century didn't help either, but mostly it was over-harvesting.
Well, and oysters are really beneficial in an area. When people want to clean out a water source or a body of water, they often bring in and seed oysters, not for food, but in order to help cleanse an area. Why are oysters so good at that? And am I right about that?
You are right. In fact, yeah, there's programs going on right now. The biggest one is in the Chesapeake, but also in Peconic Bay. Mm-hmm. And up in Washington State, there's programs going on where they're encouraging individuals, anyone who has waterfront, to grow oysters because they improve water quality. Basically, an oyster is a little pool filter, right?
Mm-hmm.
It filters up to 50 gallons of water a day through itself, and in doing so gets rid of all the algae and any other sediment that might be in the water.
We have to go to a short break, but I want you guys to think about something while we're listening to the commercials. But please listen to the commercials, because that's how we get paid. But think about the size of an oyster and 50 gallons a day. That's a busy little oyster. We'll be back in just a moment talking with Rowan Jacobson about his book, A Geography of Oysters, WCTC 1450, time is 1125.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Kathleen showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys radio show and Stage Left. I've just opened Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission, to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Kathleen Lombardi. You see, Kathleen Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Kathleen Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or KatherineLombardi.com.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Kathleen Lombardi. We're talking with Rowan Jacobson about his book, A Geography of Oysters. You can find out about the book at RestaurantGuysRadio.com. You can click right on through and order it if... you're an oyster fan, I recommend it. And if you're not an oyster fan, what's wrong with you?
Rowan, in the last show, we talked about umami quite a bit. That was kind of the focus of our last show together. But umami is a really potent and pungent and in-your-face flavor in the oyster itself. Can you talk to us a little bit about umami and oysters and how it really shows itself?
Umami is this. Tell us what the umami flavor is.
All right. The short version is umami is the flavor of amino acids, which are the building blocks that make protein. And like most meat we eat, terrestrial meat, you don't have amino acids on their own. They're all locked up in these protein molecules, so you don't taste umami. But when you break that down, you get that brothy, savory flavor that is umami. Like if you think of chicken broth or soy sauce, that's kind of an umami flavor. Shellfish have these free amino acids that give that umami flavor, which is why they're so savory and satisfying. And oysters have the clams have a lot too, but oysters have the most umami of any kind of shellfish. So you get, when you eat an oyster, you get the hit of salt right away, mm-hmm. and then you get that satisfying body, which is the umami. And then at the end, after you're swallowing the oyster, sometimes you get these crazy fruity or smoky finishes, depending on where your oysters come from.
Now, is that true? The things, this kind of subtlety you're talking about, I've only found when I have raw oysters. Is that true, or does that happen in cooked oysters as well?
Yeah, I think that all disappears when you cook the oysters. I'm not a fan of cooking the oysters in general.
You know, I've had warmed oysters, which I really do like. That's sort of a slightly different thing where you can actually warm oysters in a pan to just warm them enough that the shell just opens up.
Basically, they just open and you get them right just as they're beginning to open.
I think that's great. But cooked oysters, like fried oysters, like an oyster sandwich, that to me is more just, it's just textural. It's not really about flavor. What do you think about that, Rowan?
Yeah, I think you could pretty much fry anything in the middle of that batter and you know, it would taste pretty good with enough sauce on top of it, but it's not an oyster, really.
I'm going to come up with the fried batter sandwich. fried nothing.
I think I've had a few of those out there.
All right, we're going to go listen to the news. We'll be back talking more with Rowan Jacobson about A Geography of Oysters. We can tell you where you can find some great oysters and things to look for and things to avoid when you're buying them for yourself. 1450 WCTC, time is 1130. I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work. Until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much
vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Rowan Jacobson is one of our favorite food writers. He writes for The Art of Eating. He's also the author of Chocolate Unwrapped. He joins us today to discuss his new book, A Geography of Oysters, The Connoisseur's Guide to Eating an Oyster in North America. Rowan, you talk about where different oysters come from. We talked about how oysters can are used to clean up areas. Mm-hmm. And very often oysters are introduced to polluted or murky waters to clean them, and those are oysters we wouldn't want to eat. One of the things that's interesting about owning a restaurant is if I were to go fishing and pick up some trout or some tuna, I can bring that back into the restaurant, butcher it up, and serve it as a special that night. The two things I can't do that with that need to be
inspected
or tracked are meat needs to go through a USDA inspection, so when I go kill that deer, I need to bring it home. I can't bring it to the restaurant. And oysters and other mollusks, because they do filter. I need to not only they need to come from a licensed dealer, but I need to keep track of where those oysters came from. Why is that? And are there oysters that we should avoid that are unsafe to eat?
Well, really, the only truly scary thing to watch out for, and the reason for a lot of those regulations, is a microorganism called Vibrio vulnificus that lurks in the Gulf of Mexico.
Mm-hmm. I hate Vibrio vulnificus.
He hates it so much you can't even say it.
It sounds so evil, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does.
And it is. It thrives in warm water. Once mm-hmm. water gets up to 75 or so, then Vibrio can start to get really active. And it is responsible for killing a few people a year through raw oysters eaten from the Gulf of Mexico.
Go ahead.
That's the only place that anyone ever dies, in the United States, that anyone ever dies from eating an oyster from is the Gulf. And it has to be a raw oyster.
Here's my question to you. If I can use raw oysters to filter the pollutants out of murky waters,
right?
Don't those pollutants wind up in the oysters?
Well, what the oysters are actually filtering is algae.
Uh-huh.
When we wash lots of nutrients down into waters, it causes algae blooms.
Red tide whatever.
Yeah, all kinds of stuff that can be bad news. Oysters eat algae. That's their food. So they are filtering all the algae like they naturally would. They actually can grow faster in murky waters because murky waters are full of algae.
But if the murky waters create the algae, the oyster, the algae's not bad, and the oysters eat the algae, then I'm not really concentrating pollutants in an oyster. Is that what you're saying?
Not in general. Like, you wouldn't want to eat oysters from the bottom of the Hudson River, but the places oysters are coming from are by and large safe and are very carefully checked, just like you were saying, where there's a lot of regulations involving shellfish. Because they can, there's also a different kind of Vibrio that shows up on the West Coast that causes, garden variety food poisoning. It got a couple hundred people in New York City two summers ago.
Mm.
So that's why it's very carefully regulated. But you have to do several things wrong to really get in trouble with oysters. One is to eat them from the wrong place, and the other is to eat them at the wrong time of year. Well, summer is when these microorganisms are really active. They're frolicking in the mud, and then they get sucked into the oyster.
Mm-hmm.
Once the water temperature drops down below 70, they're not active anymore.
talk to me about different kinds of oysters and different kind of water temperatures. You have a section in your book about what kind of oyster eater are you. And a lot of people have had experiences with oysters where they had an oyster and they didn't like it, and it may be because they didn't have a fresh oyster, but it also may be because they had an oyster that wasn't to their taste. What are the differences?
It wasn't the kind of oyster that they might normally like.
And, you know, people who aren't oyster lovers don't understand this, but I love East Coast oysters from cold waters. I love them. I'm not a big fan of Gulf oysters or
there are English oysters. Or
why is that? Either. What are the differences in taste that we look for?
You know, I'm with you. For me, the oyster that just embodies oysterness is a cold, crisp, northeastern oyster.
Oh, man, you and I get along.
Yeah. And that's the cold. What cold water does is it keeps the oyster really firm. But then for salt content, you just want to look for an oyster. Oysters tend to live in estuaries or harbors, places that are sheltered from the open ocean. But the closer an oyster is to the open ocean, the saltier it's going to be. Mm-hmm. It's getting more saltwater influence and less freshwater influence.
So like the Long Island Sound is a place to get some really salty oysters.
Yeah, wonderfully briny oysters. Well, Long Island Sound gets the Connecticut River washes a lot of freshwater into there. So mm-hmm. Long Island Sound oysters tend to be milder, like Blue Points.
Uh-huh.
But if you go out to the east end of Long Island, Peconic Bay, there's less freshwater out there. And then you get those wonderfully briny oysters, like Oyster Ponds is one of my favorites that comes right out from Orient. It's got a distinctive, almost rusty colored shell, like mm-hmm. black and orange,
mm-hmm.
and the flavor is kind of like that cast iron. If you heat up a cast iron pan really hot, you start to smell it.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Yep.
That there's something a hint of that in those Oyster Ponds oysters, which maybe doesn't sound that appetizing, but it works really well.
But when you've been there, it certainly
is. Well, I guess we should talk for a second then about the mineral content in oysters and what's actually in an oyster when you eat it. I mean, oysters have sustained a lot of populations over the years of especially poor populations of people who needed, easy to eat food. It doesn't seem like an easy to get and collect and eat food, but it is actually.
Well, especially in the Pacific Northwest, where they have huge tides and fairly gentle sloping beaches, so at low tide you've got acres and acres of bottomland exposed.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the native tribes up there used that was a staple for them. Just what could be simpler?
Walk out and pick up the oyster, crack mm-hmm. it, and eat it.
Right.
Now let's talk about the oysters that I still sort of like, but like the creamy oysters or the bigger oysters. What causes them to have that creamy texture that I really don't like?
And let's talk about size at the same time.
Right. It's glycogen that gives them that creamy color.
Mm-hmm.
And that is, it's animal starch. It's how animals store starch for energy. We have glycogen in our muscles, too.
Mm-hmm.
And what an oyster does, an oyster goes dormant. It goes into hibernation in winter when the water temperature drops below 40.
Mm-hmm.
So to get ready for that, it needs to store as much energy in its body as it can so that it can sleep through the winter and live off of its energy reserves. So in the fall, it starts pumping its body fuller and fuller of glycogen, and that's when it gets big and plump and fat and a little bit sweet.
Hmm.
And most people like an oyster like that. Some people don't. Some people feel that it just sort of tastes creamy and bland, and they prefer a thinner, leaner oyster.
That's me.
Yeah. So spring would be your prime oyster season, I'd say.
Well, there's another thing. Let's talk about something our listeners can really use. What do I look for in an oyster? Because one of the big problems with oysters is they're not inexpensive from a restaurant perspective because they are very perishable. What do I look for when oysters are delivered to me? If I get a dried out oyster on my plate, is that a problem?
When they're open already and someone brings them out, what should I be looking at?
Yeah, one is you want to look for that opaque color.
Mm-hmm.
Usually, people if it's transparent, then it just spawned probably, and it's just basically a bag of seawater with a crust. There's mm-hmm. not going to be much in there. So you want it to be opaque. You definitely want to see that liquid in there.
Yeah, they call it the oyster liquor. You want to see it floating in that.
Right, because what that means is that from the moment it was hauled out of the water to the point where it made it onto your plate, it was keeping itself alive with its shell shut tight in that liquid.
Right. Well, and so when it comes to your plate, one of two things may have happened. And I see inexpert oyster shucking all the time, and you don't know whether they just spilled the liquor because they weren't good at shucking oysters, or whether that oyster has been dead for a day or so and it released the water, the
or
liquor from its
or
shell.
Longer.
Right, and so if it looks kind of dry, then I won't eat it. If it still looks wet, then I'll assume somebody just spilled it back.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll talk more about oysters and how to get those little things out of there. We'll talk about that after the break. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC, time is 11:45.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Rowan Jacobson about his book, A Geography of Oysters, The Connoisseur's Guide to Oyster Eating in North America. You should pick it up on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. And, you know, I want to point out that there is a reason that there is a tradition of seeing of an oyster bar. There is a tradition when I go to – I spoke of my favorite place to get oysters in Manhattan is Blue Ribbon. And there's a small bar, and behind that bartender is the bartender and the oysterman.
All he does for 6-7 hours in a row is open oysters.
It's difficult to open oysters, but one of the things that has arisen is the tradition of having the oyster shucker out in front where you can see him and you can watch your closed oyster be opened. And we even tip the oyster shucker. Why do you think, Rowan, that we have the oyster shucker out front when all the other food is made in the back?
Well, and I think it goes back to what you were saying about when the oysters appear on your plate and you want to try to figure out whether they're good or not. If you can see the shell and pick out your oyster and see them open it and see that the liquor and that the oyster shell was closed tight before it was opened, you know that that was a healthy live oyster until moments ago, and it's going to probably taste a lot better.
Well, and food poisoning from a bad oyster is really
unpleasant.
That's like, ooh, that's bad.
Yeah, that is.
So I want to ask you a question, Rowan. You know, all these years I watched Bugs Bunny. He opened oysters, big pearls in them. Opened a lot of oysters, a lot of American oysters in my time. No pearls.
No
What's
pearls.
Going on?
No. Well, actually, the pearls come from a totally different species called the pearl oyster, which grows in the South Pacific. And it's not an oyster. It's more closely related to mussels. So you actually can get a pearl-like thing out of an eastern oyster, but because of the materials our oysters use to make them, they're not shiny and beautiful. They're just kind of like brown lumps, which make
so
nice tokens.
Basically rocks is what we
might call them limestone.
I'm thinking that the market for pearl-like things or murky brown stones isn't really what it used to be.
True. However, apparently, a few years ago, some oyster in Connecticut got ahead of itself and created this black pearl, what looked like a pearl, which actually sold at Sotheby's for thousands of dollars. But that was one freak oyster.
Wow.
Freak oyster.
You know what? If there's going to be an East Coast Earl that makes an oyster, it's going to be in Connecticut. All right. So if I were a seagull and I wanted some oysters, I would simply pick up the oyster, fly way up in the air, drop it on a rock, and then come down and eat the oyster. Because the oyster didn't evolve to prevent flying things from breaking into them. But I can't fly, and I hate to throw things against rocks in my house. How do I get those oysters open? What are your tips?
Well, getting the right knife is key, and I'm a big fan of opening your own oysters. It's great to go to a bar and have someone do it for you, but there's also something about, you know, processed food where you have to do a little work to get the reward.
See, hold on. I'm going to disagree with you. I'm a big fan of somebody opening my oysters for me. Sorry.
Well, you know, depending on how much you value your left hand and how many scars you want on it, it can help to get someone else to do it. But in any case, there's a lot of different styles of oyster knives out there, and I have found that most of them are completely useless.
Yeah, it's a plain, blunt one is the one that I like, right? What do you like?
Yeah, you don't want it too sharp because you are invariably going to it's going to slip and head straight for your left hand if you're right-handed every now and then. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't need to be that sharp to get into the oyster. What it does need to be is thin and strong.
So, strong. It can't be pliable at all.
No, and a lot of oyster knives that are sold out there will bend on the first oyster because they clearly weren't really designed to open oysters.
Well, and now it's important when you open an oyster to open it. An oyster has a top and a bottom.
Right. You look at an oyster shell, and you'll see one half is fairly flat. The other side has what's called the cup. And you want to keep the cup down because that holds all the liquor. And, in fact, the really reputable oyster growers and distributors will make sure that cup is down pretty much all the way to you.
To make sure that the liquor, the oyster has an easier time keeping the liquor in there.
Right, now, holding at the liquor, as they say.
Now, when I open oysters, I like to open the oysters, and you go from the hinge side, and you basically break the hinge and pop the top off. It takes some skill. They sell some, they actually sell chainmail gloves out there, which for
yeah,
the,
we,
for
we've
the
mentioned
home,
these before.
Not a bad idea.
I'm a huge fan of the chainmail glove.
You put the chainmail glove on your left hand, that way if your hand slips, and the oyster knife goes into your left hand, it's still going to hurt like hell.
I was going to say, warning, this will not prevent bruising.
But you're not going to stab yourself. So then I take that oyster, for me the key is I always flip the oyster, and a good oyster shucker will flip the oyster. You take that knife and you go under the oyster where it's attached to the bottom shell still, and you cut that and you flip the oyster over so that it's just laying there in the liquor and you can just slide it into your mouth.
And that's a good point, because if you flip the oyster, you know that you've definitely detached the oyster from its bottom muscle, so it's not still attached to the bottom shell, which can save people moments of social humiliation.
Oh, my God, it's horrible.
My wife's pet peeve is that I have failed to shuck one properly, and she tosses it back, and instead of just sort of sexily slipping into her mouth, the oyster dangles from its shell above her head.
You get the oyster halfway into your mouth and part of it's held on.
And you can pretty much count on the liquor running down your chin at that moment.
You dribble a little oyster on yourself. It's really horrible. It's traumatic.
It's a bad scene.
That's really more traumatic for the oyster than it is for you.
Hey, but I want to take a short break, and I want to bring you back, Rowan, and talk about what to put on oysters. I think cocktail sauce is an anathema. People who put cocktail sauce on their oysters should be arrested. I'm going to petition the governor about that. But there are some things that are acceptable. I'm curious to hear what you have to say about that. Back in just a moment, 1450 WCTC, time is 1155.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, 1450 WCTC.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. It's Mark and Francis, the restaurant guys of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurant. Rowan Jacobson is our guest. His book is A Geography of Oysters. We were talking about oysters before, Rowan. I'm not a big fan of cocktail sauce on oysters. I think that you taste nothing but the cocktail sauce.
James Beard referred to it as the red menace.
The red. I like that. Now, if you have an overcooked shrimp, that's not very good anyway. It's not a bad way to get it down your gullet. But I do like certain things on my oysters. Sometimes I like to have my oysters, if they're great oysters, with just nothing on them, raw. Perfect.
I love a great, I'm sorry, guys, but I love just a little bit of shallot in a very, very light mignonette on my oysters.
Mignonette's red wine and pepper.
I love it.
Let's explain to listeners, it's mignonette's red wine, red wine vinegar, shallots, and pepper. Rowan?
If it's a great oyster, I want to hear everything that oyster has to say, so I usually don't put anything on it. But I agree that often a little mignonette, and less than most people put on, can be really nice. And Mark, you said a light mignonette. So would you do it with a different kind of vinegar instead of red?
Well, I would do either use a very, very mild vinegar or just a very small amount of vinegar.
Or more wine to vinegar. Well, you put red wine and red wine vinegar in. And I think that depending on the type of wine you use, that can really, like if you use a Pinot Noir or something like that, it can make it really nice and light and pretty. But the point is, what we're saying is, if you want to use a little bit of something on an oyster, that's cool. If you put cocktail sauce on an oyster, you may enjoy that. I'm not passing judgment. You know, by all means, go ahead. But you just probably paid about $1 for that oyster. And
you probably paid more than $1 for that oyster.
What you're getting is texture. Well, if you have it at home.
Mm-hmm.
What you're getting is texture, but you're not getting the flavor. And the great thing about oysters is how complex and interesting and wonderful they are.
Right. In college, we used to eat what we called poor man's oysters, which was a saltine cracker with cocktail sauce on it, and that was pretty good. But now that I've graduated to, I can afford real oysters, I don't need the cocktail sauce anymore.
Well, Rowan, your book was great. I thank you for taking the time to come and talk with us on the show about it. We're going to link it up on our website, and people can find you through there.
Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure.
It's been great. Rowan has written about a number of different things, and he always writes intelligently and well. And even if you're not a big oyster fan, this book is full of lore and history, and I enjoyed the book just as a book in and of itself. But if you are a fan of oysters, it's a tremendous reference, and I got a kick out of it. How about you, Mark?
Yeah, I liked it a lot. One of the things I enjoyed about it is that Rowan kind of enumerated all the different kinds of or the main types of oysters that are out there and gave a lot of their qualities.
I get off work at midnight tonight. I'm going right to Blue Ribbon and oysters. I hope you've enjoyed the hour being with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. Time is 12 noon.